history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are a whole lot of stories out there that you've never heard before that you ought to hear. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I said educated. Good thing we have an educator to talk to today, 95 years old, and he just published his first book. And we're going to tell you how to find that book before we're done. Robert Bradley of Albuquerque, New Mexico is my guest. You've been in Albuquerque a long time, but you didn't grow up here. Minneapolis is where you're from?
That's right, Minneapolis, the land of the Swedes and the Norwegians.
Did you have a big family?
Just one brother. Uh-huh. He lives in Los Alamos today, about 4 years younger, a retired electrical engineer.
So what kinds of things did you do as a kid growing up there in Minneapolis?
Played a lot of scrub baseball. Went fishing a lot. My dad loved to fish, and I loved to fish, too. Just a normal kidhood. Did all the things that kids did in those days, because we didn't have a lot of gimmicks to amuse ourselves with.
You mentioned baseball. Were you a good ball player?
No, we just played, you know, pickup game in the vacant lot at our block. Sometimes we had only three or four players.
And once it starts snowing, it's a little hard to play. Everybody seems to have some memories from those years leading up to World War II, particularly in the 30s, and you would have been a very young boy in grade school when the Great Depression hits America. Do you have some specific memories from that time that maybe stand in starker contrast with all the years you've lived since?
I remember the dust storms of the 30s, because some of those dust clouds would even reach as far north as Minnesota from the prairie states, you know, Kansas and Nebraska and Oklahoma. I was a great reader. I was born with a book in my hand. I think I was keeping track of what was happening worldwide, you know, the rise of Hitler. And I was thinking the other day, when Roosevelt was elected in the fall of 32, I was 9 years old. When he died, I had already been 2 years in the Army. In 45. He was president for 12 years. Didn't always agree with his policies, but he was the president to us.
Yeah, really the only one you'd ever known, I guess. Which means I'm sure you remember his voice the day after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember how you found out about what had happened way out there in the Pacific?
Very clearly. I was in the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, stationed in a little town up in, or rather in a camp up in northern Minnesota in the woods. And I was on KP that day, firing the wood stove, the coal stoves in the kitchen. And I took a break and went over to the little tiny library we had, and I was reading a book, and there was a radio in there. The announcement came over the radio of the attack on Pearl Harbor. So that's how I found out about it. They broke up the CCC, of course. I was back home by December.
Could you even make sense of that? I mean, you're an 18-year-old kid, and you're hearing this news about a place you've never been and maybe have never seen or imagined. When did it become real to you that America was now at war?
I suppose after I graduated from high school, and then I enrolled at the university in the winter and made a mess of that. So when I came out, I enrolled in what they call the NYA, the National Youth Administration, to take a course in machinist work. And so I had a few weeks of that, and then I thought every day I was seeing ads in the paper of war industries, mostly from California, desperate for workers. So I decided I'd go to California and get some work, and I did.
Did you have an idea of where you were going to work, or did you just head California blindly from Minnesota?
Oh, kind of blindly, but I fell in with another guy who was older than I was, and he kind of looked after me. I was only 19. We journeyed together to San Francisco, and we got a job at the shipyards together, and we roomed together until I was drafted.
So, and I've had a lot of guys tell me about the Kaiser shipyards, which were pretty prolific in terms of the speed in which they could turn out these vessels that the war effort was going to need. But what were you doing specifically there at Kaiser?
Well, the very simplest kind of machinist work. The LST was diesel-powered, and the diesel engines had to sit on the frame. The bedding plates had to be perfectly horizontal, smooth, you know. So I was mostly what I was doing was filing, hand-filing those bed plates and then drilling a hole for the bolts to go in. That's about all I ever did.
I've talked to a lot of guys who are working in those shipyards. Some of them decided they wanted to go get into the action, and they volunteered to join the service. Others had exemptions from the service, and they stayed there. But you don't fall into either one of those categories. What happened to you?
Well, I wasn't skilled enough to get an exemption. I didn't want one. I was sick of the shipyards. I was glad to go in the Army.
So they drafted you, and then was there a welcome to the Army moment for you when you figured out what it was really about?
Well, I was drafted at the Presidio, which is the old Spanish fort that looks over the Golden Gate. It was an Army post by that time, of course. And then I was sent down to Monterey, where I got uniforms and shots. And then they put me on the train with some other guys to go east to Aberdeen Proving Grounds. So I was in the ordnance department from then on. When I began to understand what the Army was all about in basic training, of course. We had 4 weeks of standard basic, close order drill, manual of arms, firing on the rifle range, and military courtesy. Sir. Then we had 9 weeks. We were just ordinary GIs. 9 weeks of technical training in ammunition, which they taught us all about how ammunition functions. Fuses, explosives, shells, the whole bit.
And I'm sure there are millions of guys in the war that never understood those things that you learned in those 9 weeks.
Because we were ordnance and we were ammunition supply, they wanted us to know how ammunition works. And they taught us well, very well.
Well, I'd be curious in your perspective on this now, but also if you can remember back what your perspective would have been on it then as a teenager still. But did you have any sense that what you were doing was going to be dangerous?
Oh, yeah. We knew that ammunition was, you know, sensitive. Would say. And that's all we did the rest of my Army career was handle ammunition. We threw it around like bags of potatoes.
And I ask you that if you had any idea how dangerous it was, and I'm curious if there were examples of that, where if people didn't know, they learned the hard way of how dangerous and deadly that could be.
In Normandy, we had a blow-up. I was stationed at the depot entrance with another guy, Phil Brown. And as the trucks came up from the beach, loaded with ammunition, we looked in the truck to see what kind it was, and then we directed to this sub-depot or that sub-depot or the other sub-depot. Right next to where we were stationed was a hedgerow, and then beyond that hedgerow was a dump where broken ammunition, captured ammunition, anything that was not usable was dumped in there. And one day something happened over there, and it took off, and we ran about a mile before we turned around to look back. One big explosion, then hundreds of smaller explosions after that. And the next day when we went back, the ground was littered with ammunition of all kinds and all directions. So that was a little scary.
Was anyone hurt?
I think it was 30 people were killed, two from our company, and the others were just working in there from different companies.
Well, there's no doubt after that how dangerous what you're doing was. And you mentioned Normandy, but we should probably tell the story of how you got there. So you're training there in Maryland at the Aberdeen Proving Grounds. Were you already thinking about the reality that you were going to be heading overseas at some point?
Oh, yeah. We assumed that we were. No question about it. At the end of our basic training, our 4 weeks training, we were asked if we wanted to stay in Aberdeen as part of what they call the cadre, the training cadre, or just join as a replacement. So I said, no, I don't want to stay here. I want to go wherever we're going, sir.
Don't forget the sir part. Well, tell me about that trip over. I'm guessing you'd never been on a ship on the ocean before.
The two biggest liners of the day were the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth. We went over on the Elizabeth, and there were about 15,000 of us on that ship. So you can imagine what a torpedo would have done. But it was a fast ship, so it didn't go in convoy. It went by itself. Convoy would have slowed it down to half of its normal speed. And we had no problem going across 5 days.
So they take you to England then?
Right. And I stayed a replacement for several months. I didn't join the 691st until about March. And I was finally had a company of my own, a home in the Army, you might say. Because being a replacement is miserable. You don't have any, you're not familiar with the non-coms, you don't know the officers, you don't know, you're just thrown with a bunch of guys and told to do this and do that, and don't do this and don't do that.
Well, I imagine as intellectually curious as you are, I imagine you soaked in a few things in those months in England before you were assigned to the 691st. What kinds of things did you see or hear or experience?
Mostly just miserable British camps, foul weather, cold, wet, rainy, short rations. They had to feed not only the army, our army, but the British army and the British civilian population. And most of that food had to come in from outside. So it was a miserable life being a replacement. I was so glad to find a company of my own. After I got the 691st, we were out in the country, in the Cotswold Hills in western England. And that's where our depot was located. So I never got to the cities to see any damage.
You never saw or heard any buzz bombs or anything like that?
No, at night we would hear, sometimes we'd hear anti-aircraft in the distance. Anti-aircraft and bombs falling, I guess. Couldn't be sure what they were. We'd see flashes and booms, you know.
Well, I'm just, again, I wasn't there. I'm just imagining being in your shoes. But if I'm stationed near an ammunition depot, and I know that the enemy is either sending in bombs or flying planes and dropping bombs, I might not sleep all that well. Was that thought something that occurred to you or no?
The chances of them dropping a bomb way out in the countryside would be pretty slim. Ammunition is, you can't store ammunition like you store food stacked up in one place. You got to space it out, because enemy action or accident, if it's all together, it'll all go up in one huge explosion. So you have to stack it, and you have miles and miles of road with ammunition stacks every 50 yards or every 100 yards or so.
So you mentioned how excited you were to be assigned to the 691st Ordnance Ammunition Company. What kind of duties were you assigned once you joined that company and you finally had a home?
Hard labor. Unloading trucks. Loading trucks, sorting ammunition by lot number, and that's about it. We'd go to the little local railroad station and unload the goods wagons. That's what they call our freight cars, goods wagons, much smaller than our freight cars, into our trucks, our 2.5-ton Dodge and GMC trucks. Then we'd haul it out to the depot, and we'd locate the proper sub-depot for that type of ammunition and unload it and stack it and leave it. Sometimes we had a corrugated iron shelter to over the ammunition, but sometimes it was just stacked in the open. It was packaged so it could stand the weather.
And you mentioned the tragedy that happened at Normandy, that, you know, 30 guys were killed, including two of your company. But when did you get over there? How long after the initial invasion did you cross the channel?
D plus 22, June 28th. D-Day was June 6th. I was there. Our company landed on the 28th.
Where did you come ashore, and what did you see?
I think Utah Beach. And by that time, of course, we had pushed quite a ways, 20 miles or so inland. So the beach was just one big beehive of activity. Landing craft bringing stuff in from ships offshore, and trucks coming down from the interior and hauling stuff back out.
And I know you know now how great a price was paid to capture that beachhead. Did you have a sense of that at the time, the sacrifice that had taken place there?
We didn't give that a lot of thought. We knew that the guys up front were really taking it and dishing it out, and we just did our jobs and hoped that what we did was, you know, enough to support the troops and keep them moving.
So for basically the next year, you were moving through Europe?
Yeah. The breakout came in July, I guess, when Patton's Third Army broke through and we started to sweep across France, and we were right behind them. We were so close behind that the people were still out on the streets cheering us. And we ended up in Belgium for the winter. We got there in September, and we set up 0610, which was a huge MO depot, and we operated that depot throughout the winter of 44 and 45.
Which, of course, was an infamous winter in Europe with the most extreme temperatures in decades, and soldiers from both sides freezing their digits off during the Battle of the Bulge. We'll hear about how Bob Bradley experienced that winter when we come back. Plus, he may not have encountered buzz bombs in England, but he sure did after crossing the channel. We'll talk about that. And just how big a difference did his skill with a typewriter make in the way he experienced World War II? If you'd like to see a photo of the company history he typed up in 1945 or find information on the book he has just published at age 95, The Centurion's Manuscript, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.